LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement. I was at the presidential rally on January 6th and later by the Capitol and witnessed part of the insurrection. Hear all about it on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. Watch it.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
One more swig.
Sadly, it's not liquor. Excuse me, sadly, comma, it's not liquor. Okay, all set.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenza, and joining me from Studio Parts Unknown, Studio C. This is the closet studio
is it C?
Tim Donner, host of Liberty Nation Radio. Tim, thank you for joining us.
You know, you honestly don't have to say that it's a closet studio. You act like I'm just...
It's Studio C, Tim. That's how it should be referred to.
You said closet.
I regret any inference
that it... Yeah. Look, I deny right. All allegations.
Right.
The whole point is nobody knows where I am.
You are not closeted, Tim, and nobody thinks that you are, and we're not going to talk about it anymore. Feed those rumors.
You don't really know where I am, do
Tim,
you?
Tim, I almost wanted to say, like, oh, it's good, like, has it only been a week since we recorded a podcast? It's Friday at 2:20 p.m., and boy, what a week it's been. I think that we'll just lead off with, I think, with the big story, you know, continuing on from previous shows, is that Ilaria Baldwin has now lost some of her contracts with social media influencing in response to her fake Spanish identity. Do you care to comment?
Let me just get this straight. In a week with an unprecedented insurrection at the very U.S. Capitol itself, which you covered on the ground for 2 days, we start the podcast with Mrs. Alex Baldwin.
Okay. Alec, sure. By the way. And it's Ilaria, please, if you please. Tim, I think that perhaps the Alec Baldwin for President edition of The Uprising could have moved the needle on this. We don't even know. This reporter could have actually been the cause of that. But you want to move on to other topics?
I always love when people refer to this reporter. You could just say yours truly, Scott, the way civilians do. But,
we don't have to talk more about Ilaria on this episode of The Uprising, Tim. We can talk about it some other time, but we will return to it. And at some point today, I want to talk about the death that I was witness to in our nation's capital, a confirmed death, which is the death of hospitality that I witnessed at the JW Marriott Hotel, Tim, over the course of my 2-day stay there. It was an agonizing death, and I want to report on it.
Really?
Yes.
Does it hold significance for the industry as a whole, or is it just a bad stay?
You know, when you're in the belly of the beast like that, it's hard to see the forest for the trees. So maybe we'll get into some analysis and you can tell me what your thoughts are on it. But we'll have to wait a minute, because we will go to the riot, the insurrection, as you said. In fact, so for people who don't know, I was there for 2 nights and days, as was LibertyNation.com. And let's thank the sponsor of today's podcast, and LibertyNation.com. The people's source for conservatarian news and analysis all year long.
We don't get to say 366 anymore.
Get done. So Graham Noble, who is an editor and reporter at Liberty Nation and I were dispatched to the Capitol for two days. And we reported live from the event. I will say that Graham couldn't be here because he wasn't invited, but he is here in spirit. And in fact, his spirits are here, which is this beautiful bourbon that he bought and didn't want to have to hoof around D.C. to get back to his car home. So cheers to Graham.
So I assume that because you're imbibing in bourbon on the podcast itself, that you're not going to do a timestamp this week because you wouldn't want people to know what time this was being recorded, that you had a cocktail in your hand.
Now, Tim, I already did timestamp it. You just didn't pick it up and it's past noon. And that's the most important thing. As a gentleman, knows that, and it's Friday. So,
Scott will go so far as to contact our managing editor in the UK, Mark Angelides, and ask him, has it passed 5 o'clock yet there? If so, I'm down with cocktails.
Tim, I know journalism has many low points, but also there are its benefits. As a rule, it's a drinking profession. So,
ooh, well, you picked up that part of the profession very well.
Graham also, by the way, and hero is not a word that that he chooses, but I'm applying it to him, came back with not only bourbon. Tim, the two greatest beverages that Americans have invented, and Gatorade and bourbon. So, you know,
never put them in the same class before.
Yeah.
Can you drink them together?
It was,
can you drink a,
it was, definitely, I wouldn't advise it. It was definitely, both were needed though on the day. I was surprised at just how much cardio, was involved, in what happened. And then of course, at the end of the day, boy, we did need the bourbon. So why don't we go ahead and just have a conversation about it? Maybe you can approach me as the questioner, just so, you know, I've got all the things running around in my head in terms of what's important and what's not. I don't have the sense of what it was like to experience that coverage from outside the event. So I'm curious about that.
Well, of course, we did a couple of segments on Liberty Nation Radio about this, and I think I asked most of the relevant questions, which I'll ask again here, and it starts with, I mean, you covered basically the event from end to end, though you didn't actually, you weren't embedded with the rioters, so you didn't actually go into the U.S. Capitol and witness.
No, I held back about two blocks from the Capitol building, just so the reason why I did, I was making my way to the Capitol building shortly after the first of the flashbangs went off. And the internet is completely throttled when you're in that situation. I don't know if it's because the parties, you know, the governing powers decided to turn it off so that people can't organize for violence, or if it's just the mass of folks. The pipeline there isn't enough to support any kind of speed, but you can't upload any data, any video, which is my job to do, to gather interviews and photographs and video. So still photos, you can get a few up if you're lucky, but the video just wasn't coming. So, and that's actually part of the reason why I stayed there for a couple of days, so that we could have hotel Wi-Fi, because what becomes is the only practical way to get the data out is to hoof back to the hotel, connect to the Wi-Fi, and get the stuff up. So anyway, I was going to the Congress, and right in front of me, I mean, like maybe 20 feet away or less, group of like four or five federal police SUVs and cars came down, streaming down Pennsylvania Avenue, and the protesters blocked them to prevent them from reinforcing the police at the Capitol. And so I had shot that video, and I thought that was pretty good, and so I wound up hoofing it then back to the hotel Wi-Fi. And by the time I was done with all uploading that, really the Capitol, you know, that story at the Capitol was no longer a live story. So for background.
I think the most significant question here is, you know, trying to parse what happened with maybe 1,000 people or so, as opposed to the hundreds of thousands that showed up for event.
Can we just stop that for a second? Did you see, because the Park Service doesn't do official crowd estimates anymore. Is that right? So where are we getting these numbers from?
These are just line of sight numbers. Okay. I haven't seen anything printed.
Okay. So I would just say that when I was there.
Would you disagree with that number? Would you disagree with hundreds of thousands, anywhere from 200,000 to 500,000, 600,000?
So the most in-person number experience of people I have is attending professional sporting events and concerts. And I've been at events where there's close to 100,000 people. And it seemed like there were a lot more than that on the streets of Washington, D.C. Now, I have no training in, you know, crowd numbers, right? So, but boy, and if you just look at some of the B-roll that I shot, some of the kind of background video footage where I just thought it was compelling. Literally, the numbers compelled me to make the shot, which was I just went and stood in the center of Constitution and just turned the camera on for a minute as the people just streaming by, marching their way to the Capitol. By the way, not with scowls and pitchforks, but just with kind of an intention to say, hey, this is not okay. And for the record, I was out there for, I don't know how many hours before Trump got on, but quite a few, and pretty much from the beginning, except for the super early birds. We were out there at like 7. And there was not this spoiling for a fight, a real fight of violence that I could detect or see in the crowd. I know, Tim, I don't know if you recall what it felt like to be outside a baseball stadium and have your team win the World Series. I know that hasn't happened for you in quite a while, but for me it's happened more recently.
That's great. I can tell you what, though, if you want to bring up that subject, I'm just going to say it quickly. Before you cut me off, the Mets acquired one of the greatest superstars in baseball, Francisco Lindor, this week. They will not only finish ahead of the Phillies again, but they will challenge for the National League pennant and the World Series title. So you want to go down that Mets, road, mister.
One thing we can I'm be ready. Sure of, Mets personnel decisions are always great. So I look forward to that working out, paying off well for you, Tim.
I'm sure you
do. In any case, I do recall, though, when the Phils did win the World Series and being outside the stadium and really feeling a kind of shift in the energy from a jubilant sort of celebratory mood to like a, for lack of a better term, a riotous kind of mood and thinking, oh, you know, I need to get the hell out of this area because when the police, you know, are deciding to clear it, you know, they had lined up. And it just looked like it was something that was going to turn bad, you know, very soon. So anyway, I didn't get that vibe at all. It was friendly. It was, it was a protest, but it didn't have that ominous tone. In fact, almost a year ago this week, I was at the lobby day protest of the Virginia Citizens Defense League against in Richmond and a rally, I guess they call it. And, that was a massive pro-gun rally, and that had more of a kind of a pitchfork, you know, tar and feathery vibe to it, to me, than this one did.
Now, what is your experience over the years with protests? Because you've been to more than one of them, most often not as a journalist, but perhaps as a participant,
I think now
or
it's about equal number now, probably.
In terms of
my journal, in other words, as a journalist rather than as a participant. I haven't gone as a participant since we started Liberty Nation, right? So,
right. But in your youth?
Yes, in my youth, it was mostly pro-gun rally protests and also attending as a counter-protester to anti-gun events. So the Million Mile March sticks out as one of my first big ones where I went displaying my all in favor of gun control, raise your right hand, Hitler posters, yeah, right. Which was actually funny because I literally had, I don't know, throughout the day, maybe a dozen, at least half a dozen anti-gun people stand in front of me and give the Roman salute or the Hitler, the Nazi salute in response to my sign, which must have looked really funny and interesting from across the mall to see somebody who couldn't read the sign, just to see somebody march up to me and, you know, throw that out. So anyway, somebody, by the way, had, I think this is the most genius thing I've ever seen at a protest rally. And I, you know, if I had a couple bucks to do it at another one, I would institute it myself. But some genius had a clown out there with making balloon animals that were a pro-gun message balloon animals. And all these women at the Million Mile March had taken their kids, right, to the march. And what do those kids want when they see the clown with the balloon animal, Tim? They want a balloon animal.
That's so
the balloon
really, animal says, really, like, that's yeah, totally clever.
And it's like, well, you're the one who's politicizing your six-year-old, right? I didn't do that. You did that by bringing him here. And the balloon would say, like, you know, please protect me from whatever violence, or, you know, just some funny thing that, you know, with guns, of course. And I don't know. I just thought it was genius. So
I remember going in 90 to the National Mall when George H.W. Bush was president and we were getting ready to go into the Gulf War. And it was an anti-war protest. And I'll never forget walking up and seeing this sort of rogues gallery of people. Most of them looked like the kind of person you would expect to see at a radical anti-war rally. But I walk in and I see a group of people talking, and I'm just going as an observer because I'm really interested, because like 90% of America supported the idea of the Gulf War, but these people were the radical oppositionists. I remember walking up to a small group and just kind of standing there and observing. And the first guy that he was wearing a suit and tie. He looked like one of these Washington lifers, you know, in the gray yeah, flannel suit, working in those nondescript buildings. And he said, "Bush is a madman." And then everybody agreed with him around him. I'm thinking, you know, I'm no huge fan of George H.W. Bush, but a madman? And, you know, I heard comments like that throughout the, you know, throughout this protest. And it led me to think, I wonder how effective protests really are. I mean, I think we've at least since the days of the civil rights movement, I wonder what instances do we have of massive protests actually moving the needle on any kind of significant policy? Well, does anything come to mind for you?
I'm going to make a prediction, and I don't make it with glee. Let me say that. I think we're going to see an increase in political violence in the United States, not a decrease. We're headed towards more of it.
I agree.
And I think it's because it has made a difference. It made a difference on the left. The BLM got what they wanted with their willingness to use violence. Now, they were helped by, and I want to talk about, I do think that Donald Trump bears some responsibility for the violence. I think that it's laughable to suggest that he may be, for instance, criminally charged with an incitement to violence. It's not a 0 or 100 question. It could be a 4, or it could be a 12 or a 22. I don't know where it is, but I think he has something. There's some, you know, he didn't help things along there. He hurt the country on that day. But anyway, I just mentioned that as a caveat for the 1 or 4 Trump derangement syndrome listeners who are listening and are watching the podcast and are going to say, well, what about Trump? Okay, yes, Trump. But also, before we get to Trump and the events of January the 5th, we had all the events leading up to that this year, including Black Lives Matter and Antifa rioters being aided by Democrat politicians and being lawless throughout America. And we can't, you know, and they benefited by it.
Yeah, that was the, you know, this was really the point that I made in a piece that ran on LibertyNation.com today, which would be Friday, entitled "The Trump Dam Finally Burst." And I mean, this is years of pent up frustration and rage, outrage at being labeled as rubes and racists and deplorables and irredeemables. And then the final whipped cream atop it was a stolen election. And I think what happened is that the dam finally burst when the reality of what they think is a stolen election came face to face with the Congress saying, once we do this, it's all over and there's nothing that can be done short of Joe Biden dying before January 20th. And is it unsurprising when you consider the indignities that Trump supporters have had to swallow for years? And the fact, frankly, Scott, I wrote something 2 weeks after the election that was entitled, Why are Trump voters not rioting? Which is, you don't usually run a headline saying, why is such a person not rioting? But the point of the piece was, after everything that's been heaped upon the people that support Donald Trump, not to mention the president himself, for the last 4 years, isn't it remarkable that there's been no violence from Trump supporters when we know for a almost certainty of fact, just based on recent history, that if things were reversed and the left claimed that the election was stolen, cities would have started burning down the night of November 3rd. And it didn't happen, but the dam finally burst.
I don't want to make the mistake that Donald Trump did and not at the outset of all communications after the violence say, you know, that he opposes the violence unequivocally. And I do. And you're 1,000% right. And more than that, Tim, I would say, and this is something I said well before January the 5th, why are these people burning down 7-Elevens and laundromats and pharmacies if they're angry with the way the police are treating minorities in their communities? And say what you will about the rioters and insurrectionists at the Capitol on January the 5th. I was in the streets all day until the curfew time. And at no point did I for once fear that there was going to be a business next door to me whose glass was going to explode into my eyes because somebody was rioting or there was something was going to burn down. In fact, once things finally got settled down on the night, by the time I had crawled into bed, it must have been like 9:30, the fire alarm went off in the hotel. And I did not fear for a second that the Trump people had tried to burn the hotel down. I thought that somebody got drunk and pulled a fire alarm, you know. And there was no sense of fear like that on the streets out and about. No hot dog carts were overturned. The vendors' wares were not disturbed. No cars were burned or looted. You know, none of that. All that did not take place. So
that's a critical point that you make from being on the ground is and just your instincts there saying these people don't scare me. You were around Antifa and BLM people at the last Trump rally, the second of the three in DC. And I think you made it clear you didn't want to go anywhere near those people. I mean, you saw them during the daytime, as I recall, not when they started beating people up and knifing people at night, as Antifa is so good at doing. But you made it clear to me you didn't want to get anywhere near those people. Did the people who were the most, let's just say, the most militant in the Trump crowd, these hundreds of thousands, did they scare you at all in terms of your own personal safety?
I didn't see anybody. So here's the only experience I had with any kind of even law breaking was when I saw those people turn back the police, and the streets I think were open to pedestrian traffic at that time. So actually standing in the street before the emergency vehicle got there, I don't think it wasn't like one of these Occupy protests where like the streets are open and the people just go, you know, stand there. Right. Like it wasn't that kind of a thing. So we're walking down Pennsylvania Avenue and the sirens come. And I think it's an interesting maybe psychology of the crowd thing actually is there were one or three vocal, hey, stop these guys, don't let them through types, maybe four. And that it was enough to kind of create a critical mass that people then started adding to. And it's funny, one of the loudest and most vociferous of those calling for the people nearby to block the crowd was a guy who was off. You know, I'm holding the camera up. I have my my gimbal, which is a video stabilization device, holding my camera with my cell phone with a really good camera on
the... Did you buy the gimbal at Macy's?
Very funny, Tim.
I couldn't help it.
What percentage of the audience remembers that there was a store called Gimbal?
I'm thinking that.
Who even shopped there, by the way?
I'm showing my age.
For sure, yeah. all right. You threw me off.
Okay. I threw you off. So, I do that all the time. I don't mean to. Well, maybe.
So anyway, so I have my device and I'm pointing it this way. And what I wanted to do, and I couldn't without ruining the shot I had of the cops, the guy's off to my right and behind me, and he's standing in this median area where he's fully protected with like concrete bollard and like signposts. And he's telling the other people, and I wanted to say, hey, buddy, why don't you get your ass over there? And what, like, you're their coach or what? Why aren't you actually, you know, you're talking a good game, but why aren't you over there doing it? Anyway, I never got the chance to say that, but it was curious. It was like I said, maybe I heard like three really powerful voices commanding people, directing them. Don't let these people pass in the crowd did in, you know, sufficient number that they couldn't move forward. They couldn't move past it. So that was the kind of big, that's the only lawlessness I saw. You know, during the day, you see some people, they're in like tactical gear. But you don't know that's not like their own cosplay or you don't know what their deal is. It's like, you know, I've just seen in more and more at protests, I've seen people so attired. And I've never once before, you know, these are protests where there's not even been reports of violence from people so attired. So I saw that guy in that... you know, the guy with the horn and the fur pants or whatever without a shirt on with the makeup
right.
on his face.
Right.
I saw that guy earlier in the morning. He was out there at like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning on right on 14th Street, I think. And, you know, in fact, I said to Graham, hey, get a picture of that guy, you know, with the horn on his head. I mean, that was.
So let me ask you this. Did you sense, and I asked you this from having been to, again, the last Stop the Steal rally before this one. Did you sense the presence or did you see any evidence of any kind of presence by Antifa and BLM? Of course, it was during the day when most of this was going on and they do all their work
well
after dark.
I saw them the last one. They were around, just not in numbers. They weren't swarming or attack or anything, but they were there. I didn't see any of them visibly, you know, identifying with those groups. By the way, there are plenty of black people there protesting the results of the election and in support of Donald Trump. They weren't hard to come by.
That's interesting.
And I did not, but I know I didn't see anybody in Antifa gear. And in the last one I had seen, a fair number of counter protesters, but not this time.
So Scott, the thing is, I mean, another element of the piece that I wrote for LibertyNation.com is that, I mean, it's remarkable to see the difference in reaction of the so-called allies of rioters. And what I mean is, over the summer, as we discussed ad nauseum, it seems like there were all these riots and neighborhoods being burned down, businesses destroyed, all of this stuff, police stations taken over. Defunding the police becoming a popular rallying cry, all this stuff, as, you know, 20 people died in the first month of rioting. But the left and the Democrats said nothing. They said absolutely nothing. Why? Because these were their people. Joe Biden was already leading in the race, basically because of the pandemic and all it had done to the economy. And
well, please hold on just a second, Tim. People. Just put a pin in your point.
Okay. Hold on.
From my perspective, the people in charge, by and large, they didn't. It's not that they said nothing. I think you're wrong about that. What they said was, the percentage of people that are committing violence is small relative to the percentage of people that are there legitimately expressing their First Amendment views mm-hmm. and their legitimately held grievances that the United States is a fundamentally racist, horrible society that murders black men at will for no reason and other scandalous.
I'll tell you what that is. You know what that is? Plain and simple. That is explaining away murderous violence by trying to, absorb the whole thing within a much larger context. But the point I'm making is, okay, you could say they didn't ignore it.
They justified it
because they had the megaphone of control of the media wing of the Democratic Party, which refused to condemn what was going on. And Democratic politicians wouldn't say anything. Liberals, leftists wouldn't say anything other than, well, it's justified and it's a small percentage, whatever, which is just
for people who don't know.
That's just
what we believe is that they, in a coordinated, although not explicitly like signed like a contract, but they had a coordinated effort that chaos in the United States would accrue to Donald Trump's defeat at the ballot box. And that's absolutely.
why they
did those things. Right. I'm telling, I know that you know, Tim, I'm telling people in the audience who may not have reached that conclusion about what we're kind of reading in between the lines, and that's what we believe that went on in their decision desks, basically. Okay.
So to complete the thought or the second half, which makes the first half make some sense, is we all know, at this point we spent a long time discussing how the left explained away all this violence that destroyed so many lives in the middle of a pandemic.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Sure.
With the pandemic and all of this, and we heard nothing in the way of condemnation. We heard just excuses, justification from Democratic politicians. Now, compare that to the reaction on the right among conservatives to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. It almost made you nauseous.
Yeah.
The parade of conservatives lining up to get on TV to say how awful it was. We don't do this. We're conservatives. We don't riot.
It was so ridiculous.
It was ridiculous, but it was also revealing of the basic difference between the left and right. And the right immediately condemned people of their own party, presumably. Whereas the left and the Democrats would never do that because they had the protection of the media wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, it's pretty much that simple. And now those same people, of course, are becoming completely hypocritical. People like Chris Cuomo on CNN and Don Lemon, the most appropriately named man on television, are now suddenly up in arms and saying this is something that threatens our very democracy when burning down stuff over the summer didn't bother him at all.
I saw Mitt Romney's speech that was applauded by Democrats on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and it occurred to me that it's rumored that the Mormons control the JW Marriott. Now, I haven't made any connection there between the death of hospitality that we experienced while quote unquote guests at the property. But that's something.
Did you look in the drawer next to your bed?
No, Tim, I did not.
You didn't? Well, if you had.
There was no drawer next to my bed because the furnishings did not provide for.
However, if you were at another Marriott hotel.
Right.
With a drawer.
Right
next to the bed, you could even look in the desk.
Right,
you will find the Book of Mormon.
Okay,
I've seen it many times myself. You go into first hand
reporting
hotel rooms
from various Marriotts across the country. Timothy Donner, thank you, appreciate that first hand account.
Yeah, is that multiple instances? So, no, it's interesting too because you go into other hotels, and at least up till recently, maybe they don't even do it anymore. But there's they put a Bible in every hotel room.
The Gideon Bible.
The Gideon Bible.
Is that different from
sort of purpose.
Does their version, Tim, have any edits that you quarrel with as a as a member of the Fourth Presbytery?
You want to drill down on theology, do you?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Now, Gideon's is actually more the group that distributes the Bible for that very purpose, which is to get it into hotel rooms so people will read it. And but in Marriott's, it's not a Bible.
Right.
It's the Book of Mormon.
You know, I don't know if this is still a thing, but there was a thing like a while ago with some movement atheists who they would call down to the front desk and be like, yeah, somebody left this Bible in my room. Like, you know, to express the fact that we don't want, you know, that's not a value added for everybody's
stay.
There
must be a mistake because there's a Bible in my room.
Right.
There must be some mistake. Your housekeeper... Your housekeeping crew must have overlooked that.
Well, I think it's like, hey, it's like it's a proselytizing thing, and it's not welcome. I think was the gist of it. You know, the statement that you made about how the media, the big box media, the legacy media is now turning, I think is without question what's happened. I don't know. I guess you can't continue to be shocked with the breathtaking hypocrisy that you see all the time.
You knew it. You know what? I mean, the thing I said about Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo, I could have written those remarks before they actually made them,
Tim,
because you knew
we're
they
only
would
gonna
do
play
that.
One,
it's that predictable.
We're only going to play one clip from this uprising, this episode of The Uprising. And let's take a moment to thank once again the sponsor of today's show, LibertyNation.com. LibertyNation.com is a proud content partner with WhatFinger.com, and WhatFinger is a news aggregator website which presents a curated list of content from around the web at the best of what they can bring to the table. And one of the best things they could bring to the table on January 5th was live reporting from the U.S. Capitol for Liberty Nation News by this reporter and that of Graham Noble and our whole team. So I've just sent you via Slack message the clip I want you to play. Tim, why don't you go ahead and fire that up, and we'll hear from Mr. Cuomo on the BLM.
See the protests as the problem. No, the problem is what forced your fellow citizens to take to the streets. Persistent and poisonous inequities and injustice. And please, show me where it says that protests are supposed to be polite and peaceful, because I can show you that outraged citizens are the ones who have made America what she is and led to any major milestones. Be honest, this is not a tranquil time. They're not here to make power or you or me comfortable. They're here to yell, criticize, blame, and shame. You don't have to like it. But why not focus on remembering the reason for the pain that fuels their purpose?
Why not focus on the reason for the pain, Tim?
Thank you for playing that.
Yeah.
I appreciate you bringing that forward. And by the way, when I referred to that, I didn't even know you were bringing it forward. But, you know, again, you can write these stories in advance. I mean, you can pretty much write what they're going to say about Trump on January 20th when he leaves town. You can write in advance what they're going to say about his legacy. You can write in advance how history will now view Trump after he stokes an insurrection. I mean, it doesn't make it any less outrageous and flagrantly biased, but it's become standard fare, Scott.
This is why we're going to have more political violence, Tim, because there's no recognition of what happened before as violence, and they've treated what's happened on the 5th, I think, like there was much more violence than there was. I read this account today, this morning, from a New York Times photojournalist who recounted her horror at being set upon by a group of pro-Trump, what did you call them, insurrectionists at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And they grabbed her credentials, saw that it was the New York Times, were outraged at that. She thought they might beat her to death. They didn't touch her at all, except for knocking her down and stealing her camera equipment and credentials, which is, of course, unacceptable, and they should be criminally prosecuted for doing so. But you know what they didn't do? They didn't beat her. They didn't treat her like an attendee at a Trump rally in Silicon Valley who just wished to exit and go to their car, for instance. You know, this violence that has been set upon those of us on who aren't leftists or progressives by progressives and leftists has been palpable for many, many, many months, if not longer. And this one incident has been treated like it's a Holocaust instead of a blip compared to what has happened before. I think that that's where my recipe for future violence all baked in the oven. And here we go.
Yeah, I can't disagree. I mean, I wish I could, but most of that kind of optimism has completely drained out of me. And you know what? If you think it's over, it's not. We've had basically, first of all, Nancy Pelosi saying that if they don't invoke the 25th Amendment, she's going to go ahead and start another impeachment hearing.
Great.
But beyond that, Scott, we've got
just what we need, by the way, is more chaos, more gasoline.
We've had an actual statement from an actual sitting member of Congress and support from others for the idea that once Trump is gone, they will seek vengeance against Trump for what he's done to the country. They're not satisfied with just beating him. They didn't seem very happy actually winning the election against him. I was surprised how not overjoyed they
were. They're going to be sore winners, Tim.
They're going to be sore winners.
Talking about how they're going to try to deny any income source for the people who served in the administration.
But they're going to exact revenge. In other words, Hank Johnson, who's an elected member of Congress from Georgia, I believe.
Who famously worried about Guam sinking.
He said, we must do whatever it takes to make sure that Donald Trump or anyone like him, if they think they can come in and do what he's done the last 4 years, well, he basically said, we need to punish these people. We need to send them out to pasture. We need to shame them
Michelle
to the
Obama
point
says,
where they can't
Michelle
even
Obama
participate
says,
in society.
Michelle Obama says Silicon Valley should shun Donald Trump, remove all his platforms, and see to it that future administrations aren't allowed to basically or
do anything
or
that the establishment doesn't want them
put
to
forth
do.
messages that she doesn't approve of. And if you get that the Joe Biden administration is really a third Obama proxy administration, that's if you're Google or any of those platforms, you better think twice about defying Michelle Obama.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the message. Here's the message to Trump supporters as a three-pronged message that they've gotten over the last 4 years. The bottom line, the sad but realistic conclusion that they will have to reach if they haven't already, which they probably have. Trump supporters writ large. Part one, the left can do anything they want because with the protection of the media wing of the Democratic Party, it'll all be justified and explained away. Part two, the right will only find America First or MAGA or the populist movement led by Trump to be to their liking if it can gain them power and keep them there. Otherwise, they'll throw Trump overboard and his supporters in a New York minute. And
okay,
part three is that if you are a true outsider who intends to come into D.C. to march in and drain the swamp, you might be able to surprise these people once, but you cannot survive because they will do whatever it takes to make sure that you will not survive.
We're going to talk in a minute about what's in store for the country under Democrat control of both houses of Congress and the presidency. But before we do that, let's speak for a minute about Donald Trump's actions and culpability is not exactly the right word, but close enough. Do you think he bears any responsibility, Tim, for whipping the people up into a frenzy that turned violent at the Capitol?
Well, I think that revolves around the question of how angry these people would be if Trump had, for example, said nothing since the election. There's this idea that these people were whipped into a frenzy because, my goodness, they didn't even realize all the evidence that Trump had that he laid out in extensive detail in that speech. And when they heard that, they were outraged. I don't think so. They knew this. They're, his supporters are very, very, very informed. They knew this stuff already. I have to believe that the people that were planning to riot were planning to riot no matter what Trump did.
What about
will Trump
this
be blamed? Of course he will.
Big protest in D.C. on January 6th tweet, be there, quote, it will be there, comma, will be wild, exclamation point.
Mm-hmm. Well, no? That, we say that about every kind of event. Oh, it's going to be wild.
Has
what
Trump,
does that mean?
Has
that
Trump
doesn't
said
mean
that?
Anything.
No.
Well, it's going to be wild. Just means we're going to have tons.
Look,
of
I'm not asking. I'm not saying you're giving evidence in court for a criminal prosecution. Right, right. But you, there's really there's no there there. See, I think there is something there there.
Well,
be there,
there is.
Will be wild. I think that is a call, not towards. You know, again, I'm not saying the man should be prosecuted or he anticipated actual violence. But there's something there that is. He's not calming the waters there, is he?
No, I don't think anybody could. Nobody's going to claim, least of all me, that he's calming the waters. But, you know, when you have the most powerful position in the world stolen from you, you're utterly convinced and you present mountains of evidence in a speech form. And I don't know, you know, that begs the question, too, of is he just pulling these numbers out of whole cloth because they say the elite media says there's no evidence
without foundation.
Cleanest, you know, I mean, all of that stuff. Look,
claimed without Trump, foundation.
Did Trump contribute to an atmosphere that might have led to this? You can't say he didn't. Maybe he did. But what I'm saying is these people came there after years of being shamed, years of being demonized and called deplorables and irredeemables.
And lied to.
And lied to. And
over and over again about Donald Trump, lied to about him being a Russian spy.
They lied about the fact that he was an illegitimate president. For 4 years, they impeached him over a phone call. They invented the whole Russia collusion thing, which took oxygen out of the room for 2 years. And so these people, the idea that Trump just suddenly incited a violence in them that they had not demonstrated for all these years, and even since the election 2 months ago, which 75% of them believe was stolen, they had done nothing. So I have to believe these people had violence on their minds from the beginning. I don't really believe that Trump incited it per se, because these people already knew what they'd come to do. That's my opinion. I can't prove it. But I heard Trump's speech. I watched the whole thing. He laid out every single detail that he could in the time allotted. What did you think of the speech? And what do you make of I wanted to get your take on this.
Yeah, I have not listened to the speech.
Well,
in a way. No, hold on a second. I have not listened to the speech in a way of like, let me listen to the speech and hear what Trump is saying. The only time I listened to the speech was on the day in question. And it was just with a mind to where do I need to put my butt in Washington, D.C. to get the best video and still photos of these folks when they come go from the white. And
okay, but
the one thing I did notice, by the way, was when he said he was going to march with them, basically, down the Constitution to the Capitol. So that could actually, you know, again, add fuel to the fire of Trump whipping people up. And the other thing, too, is I really think, and, you know, there's been this parade now of cabinet officials who are resigning. And it's hard to know for some of them if it's, you know, a real cowardice moment or like, is it a profile in courage? Like, what are they? You know, like Betsy DeVos has said, you know, she resigned him and we know she's a friend of the podcast. She's a class act. Is this a movement of political cowardice? Because Trump doesn't have political power now, so people don't want to be associated with him. Or,
well, look, yeah, one of the things that he's quickly learning is that once you don't have power anymore, they're going to throw you overboard in a second, especially if you're an outsider that wants to come and tear everything up. They don't. They want to move on from that as quickly as possible. You can see Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, they're like wiping their hands of any involvement in this at this point, because they're institutionalists who care about sustaining the status quo in Washington. And a guy like Trump comes in, and that's why I'm saying he can't survive. It's a miracle, honestly, looking at this, Scott. It's actually a miracle that he was able to win even once. And I think it was only because they wrote him off and ridiculed him and said he doesn't have a chance. He doesn't have a chance in the world to win. If they, at this time, they didn't make that mistake. And they were ready for him. And when they're ready for a guy like this, one man against the world is always going to win. He fought the law. The law won.
Did you see that Joe Biden is saying he's going to name Merrick Garland as his attorney general?
Well, you got to say, if there's one person that kind of deserves an early appointment in the next Democratic administration, it's probably poor old Merrick Garland.
By the way, I really do sincerely consider that a demotion. He's a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. He's got a lifetime appointment to the second most important court in our nation, and he's going to give that up to be Joe Biden's water boy, because that's the that's what he's going to appoint as an attorney general. Obama had the most political attorney general in history, and
well, it's the
Eric Holder, by the way, for people who don't know, we documented plenty of it on the Liberty Nation Radio, your show, throughout the 8 years of the Obama administration, and how he so politicized that office more than any other AG. And the Democrats have more of a history of this than the Republicans do. Janet Reno. And so why would Merrick Garland want to join that group? It just seems like,
well, has he been appointed already?
Well, he can't be appointed because Joe Biden's not president.
No, but I mean, has he been named?
Oh, this has been widely reported that
oh, I didn't even realize that. So that means DeVal Patrick is not going to get it.
Sad to say, your old friend and
because we were talking name. About.
Yes,
I thought that they really,
maybe he'll be the second choice. if they somehow are able to, how funny would it be just for form's sake if they refuse to vote on the nomination of Merrick Garland?
I'd have to say that would be one amusing moment.
So before we go, let's talk about what's going to happen with the Democrats. They now will have a Congress where they control both the House and Senate and the presidency, Tim. You know, if you gave me control of the presidency and the House and Senate, you will quickly learn where my priorities lie, because I wouldn't start with putting trash cans back in the national parks, which is an outrage that they took them away, by the way, and they should be put back. But I would start with dismantling the drug war, because I see that as the greatest threat to liberty, justice, and freedom in our country.
Not going to happen.
No. I'm saying that's what I would do if I had those keys to the car, because that's what I would say is the most urgent thing. So what will we learn is most urgent and important for Democrats? What will they go to, and what can we expect?
Well, I think we'll get a sense of the state of the party, which, lest we forget, through all this roiling controversy and the riots and all of this stuff about the election, you know, what we've got coming up is the third time since, let me make sure I get this right. Yes, the third time since 2008 that a single party will control the House, the Senate, and the presidency. 2008-10, it was the Democrats. 2016-18, it was the Republicans. In both instances, per the full sweep of American political history, the out party trounced the in party in the midterm elections. So when you can,
but before the elections, what's going to happen?
It's a mixed blessing to control all three.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for, right?
I mean, yeah, because now, I mean, Mitch McConnell may not be all that upset because now everything that happens for the next 2 years, and it's not going to go well, are going to be blamed on the Democrats because they control the Senate. They control the House.
But I want you to
get
back to the question I've posed, please. What will they do with their power?
Okay, they have two choices. They have two basic choices. If they want, they can go radical. They can go for D.C. as a 51st state. They can go for getting rid of the Senate filibuster under any circumstances, not just for judicial nominees. And they can go essentially full scorched earth. They can try to add Puerto Rico and Guam. They can do all of that.
Oh, that's a revolution right there because
that's a revolution.
Six Democrat votes for the Senate in perpetuity.
But they have talked of doing those kind of radical things.
And packing the court,
yeah. Adding Supreme Court justices.
That there's a real chance of that? They're trying for it? That is well, not that's, succeeding.
That's option A. That's column A. Column B is...
That's the fake mandate option. We'll call that the fake mandate, that they've somehow gotten a mandate from the...
I don't think it matters to them whether they've gotten a mandate or not. It's whatever they can get away with.
Right.
With an eye, remember, because they're still politicians just like Republicans. And what do politicians think about above all else? The next election and sustaining their power. So column A would probably result in them being booted out in record numbers in 2 years because people don't support that stuff. D.C. is a 51st state. Packing the court with six or seven new Supreme Court justices, even two or three, FDR was brought low by that many, many decades ago. Column B is you immediately line the pockets of people who've been struck by the pandemic. You send more relief. The individual Americans, you'll be unobstructed in trying to do so. Mitch McConnell won't stand in the way.
Let the checks roll out.
Climate change. A lot of re-regulation of the energy industry will certainly happen. We're going to get taxes that are going to be increased. It's only a matter of how much and when.
I think they
will try to probably get a public option for Obamacare. I think that would fall into column B, not into column A. I predict they'll go with basically with column B, which is they'll try because they know, look, they're hanging on by a thin reed. Yeah, they may control the House and the Senate, but their House majority collapsed. They lost 14 seats in 2020. And in the Senate, where they were down three, they probably should have had a clear majority. Instead, they've got 50-50 and Kamala Harris breaking the tie. So those are really margins that are as thin as a reed. And they know already that it's highly unlikely that they can hold the House in 2022 because history shows that the out party almost always succeeds in midterm elections. They know that. So I think they have to try and, but I don't know whether they have any party discipline. I mean, you've got AOC on the one side saying outright Nancy Pelosi doesn't deserve to be speaker. She doesn't have the votes to assure that she'll get another term as speaker. In the Senate, I mean, 50-50, you can't exactly call that a mandate. And they're dealing with a president who's some people feel is bordering on non-compos mentis and who people openly question whether he could even complete one term to be replaced by a woman so widely unpopular and unlikable as Kamala Harris, who just, you know, nosedived in her own presidential campaign. She doesn't have any real support within the party. So this is a party that's really on the edge, even though I've never seen before where a party that controlled the presidency and the Senate and the House was so teetering on the edge. And I think because of that, they go more with column B. I don't think they can do the statehood for D.C. and packing the courts and getting rid of the Senate filibuster. I just don't see it happening, if only because of their concern for their own political future.
Spouting Latin in his shirt sleeves from Ray Studio C. Loquitur.
Did you like that? Did that impress you?
Thank you for joining us, Timothy Donner. We'll see you next time on The Uprising.
Can't wait.
That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, the Rabbit Hole podcast, Liberty Nation Radio, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of libertynation.com, conservative news where truth matters.